morning, ladies and gentlemen. Do we have counsel on the first case? Please be seated at counsel table. Our first case this morning is Jackson against Racine County. Ms. Radke.
Is it on?
Please proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Sandra Radke, and I represent the plaintiffs, Brenda Jackson and Sherry Lasecki, in this matter. This court, sua sponte, ordered us to have a joint brief with the other plaintiffs with common facts, Patricia Burchell Seeloff, as well as Linda Schultz, Neen Nutt. For years, this court has told us that it will not stand as a super personnel department second-guessing business decisions of management, but that is exactly what the defendant is asking you to do in this case. Document 55 in the record, Exhibit 15, is the Sexual Harassment Committee report of Racine County. And this is a very detailed and thorough investigation that they did into the complaints of my clients.
Could I ask you, Ms. Radke, just to be clear, the briefs gave me a ship's passing in the night feeling about this report, because on the one hand, one might argue that that you are at least proffering it for its evidentiary quality as an evidentiary admission along the lines of what we've discussed in various cases. On the other hand, maybe you're proffering it as a judicial admission, and I want to be clear at least as to what you think we ought to be considering.
Well, I think you ought to consider it as a judicial admission.
Now, why should it be, in light of the fact that it was prepared for a different purpose and it didn't go through the Rule 36 procedure, a judicial admission?
Well, I think you have the case of a defendant trying to have its cake and eat it too. They availed themselves of the affirmative defense, in this case the Farragher-Ellerth affirmative defense.
Well, I understand that, but one could look at this report, and it's got, let's say, raw interview data and that kind of material in it, and it's got a conclusion. And I guess I had thought, anyway, it was unclear to me, which is why I'm asking the question, that you were saying evidentiary admission. I mean, because I suppose there are three levels. A, don't use it at all. B, use it as an evidentiary admission. C, use it as a judicial admission. But I'm not sure why they should be irrebuttably, you know, stopped at this point from saying, as they're trying to say, this was done for a somewhat different purpose. Maybe there's overlap, but maybe it's only 80%, or maybe it's something else.
Well, you'd ask what I thought on the sort of a three-tier thing, and I guess I think this is very reliable evidence. This investigation is more thorough than your normal sex harassment committee investigation. They interviewed 21 witnesses and substantiated 40 different allegations. They went out of their way to use some of the buzzwords of Title VII. They found severity, they found pervasiveness, and they found a hostile work environment. Notably, none of those terms appear in their own sexual harassment policy. Mm-hmm. So I think it's clear in this case that they were using it as an analysis of Title VII. On the other hand, if the court deems, well, we don't want to use it as a judicial admission, I think then next we need to look at it as an evidentiary matter that should get us to a jury.
There you have a different problem, and I don't mean to cause you to jump ahead of yourself in your argument, but even if we were to agree with you and to disagree with the district court that the environment and the behavior of Mr. Larson amounted to sexual harassment, as that's understood in the law, you eventually come to the point where you've got to confront the Farragher-Ellerth affirmative defense. And as you say, it is an impressive response on the part of the county. They did a very thorough investigation. And why doesn't that, in the end, torpedo your case.
It simply does not torpedo my case, first of all, because it is a comprehensive thing that I think it shows that reasonable minds could and, in fact, did find a hostile work environment here based on severity and pervasiveness. Secondly, nothing in this report will prevent them from availing themselves of the affirmative defense under Farragher and Ellerth. They didn't follow the recommendations of this committee. So to say that it torpedoes it, I'm not sure I'm following.
But they did discipline Mr. Larson. They just didn't fire him. They demoted him. They pay him less. I mean, there's something happened, in other words. He's not in that place anymore. They took action.
Well, I guess now we will jump ahead of my argument. Did they discipline him ultimately? No, I'm going to say they did not. This man took a voluntary demotion. He did not know he had been demoted until well after he was in the new position.
But he's paid less, right? I mean, I don't know what's outside of the record, but it's certainly the case that sometimes people will say, if you move quietly, then we're going to call it even, as it were, you know, and they... Why isn't paying him less a significant measure?
Well, first of all, it's not a significant measure because of the time frames we're talking about here. This employer was on actual adequate knowledge of what kinds of allegations we're talking about. A kiss on the lips, quid pro quo demands for promotions, sexual innuendo of multiple people, at least four people. And they knew this by February 16th. And
is that clear, though? Because
yes.
They say that the complaints that came to them were not nearly so informative.
Absolutely not true. There might be some debate. We would argue that they knew as of October through informal complaints to Marta Kultgren, the human resource manager. However, it is absolutely undisputable that Marta Kultgren interviewed people on or about February 16th. Her notes are in the record. And she indicates that she was aware of kisses, touchings, comments, and the quid pro quo demands to Sherry Lasecki for a promotion. That's when they knew undisputably, and yet that's when they stuck their collective heads in the sand. They did nothing. And it's because they were hung up on the fact that our clients didn't want to file a, quote, formal complaint, a requirement that does not even appear in their own policy. Second, they did nothing to try to prevent the sex harassment from that time period until matters got worse and the women joined forces, so to speak, and actually came forward, and that's how this committee report came to be. So I would direct the court's attention to that entire time frame from February until June when this report came out, that they did nothing. They really cannot substantiate that they took any action against Larson during that time frame. Did that answer your question adequately?
Yes, that's fine. Thank you.
As far as moving on to whether or not it is severe and pervasive, even just if you disregard this report, which I would argue against, but the defendant in this case is arguing that we should parse up the plaintiffs and parse up the allegations, and we should take the allegations and put them into neat little categories of comments and physical touchings and alleged innocuous acts. And I would like to say that I believe that's the wrong analysis under, you know, the Ancali, Meritor, and Harris cases. And it deprives the women of the frequency and unrefuted pervasiveness that we're dealing with here. The court really passes over the fact that we have testimony from a number of the witnesses saying that every day he would look at me. Every day, regularly, there were emails. I mean, it's not a few isolated events. And then interspersed with these everyday things that are on perhaps the lesser end of the spectrum are more severe acts that are actually targeted and overtly sexual. So I think when you take the approach that everybody's arguing here, slice and dice, if you will, you're depriving the plaintiffs of the mosaic theory of a hostile work environment and not letting them get in the context and how the environment was actually working there. For example,
Counsel, you wanted to leave some time for Ms. Knight, I take it.
Yes, right. I'm not seeing the light.
Your red light has already been on, indicating that the time you wanted has already elapsed.
Judge, I'm not seeing any light whatsoever.
Got turned off.
There will be about 4 minutes left for Ms. Knight at this point.
Okay, I guess I'll wrap up then.
Ms. Breeze Jake.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Joanne Breeze Jake. I'm one of the lawyers with the law firm of Hashtag Hensel and Bickler. I'm here today representing the appellee, Racine County, in this matter. As a preface to my argument, I need to point out that this is a case involving four separate plaintiffs that was consolidated for purposes of briefing, but not for purposes of analysis of the separate claims. This court and other courts have made clear by virtue of cases such as Cowan that sexual harassment is a personal claim and it's something that relates to the person and their various circumstances as set forth in the affidavits that they submit to the court. Criticism is leveled in the briefing against the district court's decision, indicating that for some unexplained reason it didn't sufficiently consider the severity of the alleged actions.
Well, I think that's not quite the gist of it. I think the gist is that, as is well recognized, the standard for this, ultimately the question is really functionally one of sex discrimination. Is this environment being made a term and condition, if you will, of employment that's discriminatory? But beyond that, it can be either severe or pervasive. And if it's pervasive, just, you know, the Chinese water torture, if you will, day by day by day, degrading and insulting and boorish and inappropriate behavior, that's enough too. And actually what I would like you to address, if you wouldn't mind, is one of the things that Ms. Radke said toward the end, which was that as of at least February, the human resources people knew, that particularly that one woman knew that this was the gist of the complaint. You had said in your brief that the formal complaint that went to her was a very limited one, but I take it the argument on the other side is that through a variety of channels, the county was in fact aware that this man was behaving in such an inappropriate way.
Right. The argument of the plaintiffs is twofold. One is that Patricia Burchell-Seeloff was speaking with Marta Kulchin over a period of time, and then again in February there were issues raised. With respect to Burchell-Seeloff's conversations with Marta Kulchin, while the allegation is made, the fact is that her testimony was that she had been speaking with Marta Kulchin about, quote, management techniques of Mr. Larson. She spoke about unhappiness with his performance and lack of attention to his job duties. And then she indicated it wasn't until later, and I could not give you the specific date, that I was telling her of an incident Mr. Larson had with Lori Miller. And she also said she couldn't say how much she had said to Marta Kulchin prior to February. February is when Burchell-Seeloff did contact Marta Kulchin and indicated that there had been some type of an inappropriate statement made to Lori Miller. When asked whether anyone else was having these types of problems, Burchell-Seeloff indicated she wouldn't know. That was her response. Marta Kulchin advised Burchell-Seeloff that she was a supervisor in the department. If she knew of these things, she should be making HR aware of them. The next day, Burchell-Seeloff called back and named Lasecki and Jackson as two people who may also have information. Marta Kulchin, while the committee, anti-harassment committee, did not call this an investigation, she did do an investigation. She's a member of the committee. She contacted Jackson. She contacted Lasecki. She contacted Miller. She spoke with each of them. They gave very limited information, and each one of them admittedly said it was under control. It was not something that they wanted to file a formal complaint, that they had not had problems after they had asked Mr. Larson to stop. Lasecki's testimony in her deposition confirms that she did say as of January 25, 2002, when she asked Mr. Larson not to touch her, all of the treatment that she believed to be sexually harassing did stop.
Well, but then in her brief, she responds to that in a sense that he entered a punitive phase, if you will. He started freezing her out of various things, which, of course, isn't appropriate either.
And that's the shunning argument. Lasecki's testimony did not go to an inability to do her job in that regard. She was not demoted. She was not put in a worse position. She was not shunned in a way that would be an adverse employment action. She testified that Mr. Larson stopped doing things that she found to be sexually harassing as of that point in time. And with respect to the affirmative defense, next, what happened is Mr. Larson was spoken with. He was confidentially told generally that inappropriate workplace behavior is not something Racine County will tolerate. Case law is clear that you need to respond to the nature of the allegations in a way that's concomitant to the allegations themselves. And Racine County was acting reasonably with respect to what was going on here and not ignoring the circumstance, certainly, but honoring what the plaintiffs themselves had asked to occur.
Does the record give any more detail about what it was specifically that finally triggered the comprehensive investigation? I remember seeing
Yes, there in the record, I believe it's Mark Yaniuk's affidavit.
Yaniuk, yeah.
Mark Yaniuk, who was at the time Corporation Counsel for Racine County, had a meeting with some of the plaintiffs. And during the course of that meeting, there was a comment made to the effect that Mr. Larson was attempting to move a woman named Susan Leger over into the department because he liked Susan Leger. Mark Yaniuk responded to that comment by calling Marta Kulchin and saying, I want to do a comprehensive investigation of everything going on in that department. And Marta Kulchin at that point said, yes, that's a new allegation. I agree. We should do that.
So just that one, the thing that seemed so strange to me was that one allegation in isolation suddenly triggers finally the comprehensive investigation. It makes me wonder whether one could draw an inference that they were aware that there were rumblings, at least, that there was this...
Well, they were aware
pattern of behavior.
There were rumblings. There was some sexual harassment training held, I believe it was in March.
Right.
And when Mr. Larson was spoken with, it was known that he was going to be attending that. Following that training, some of the plaintiffs approached a woman named Alice Oliver and raised, again, the same things that Marta Kulchin had been told in February. There were no new allegations.
But if they're still raising it as of March, it suggests that maybe things haven't really been fixed.
Right. And Marta Kulchin's response to that, and the committee response via Marta Kulchin, was to send an email, including both Jackson and Lasecki, because they were the only two who had been identified as having, two plaintiffs in this case, as having any issue. She also emailed the other individuals who had been identified in February, asking them whether there was any ongoing problem and whether there was anything else that needed responding to. Jackson did not respond to the email. Lasecki responded by saying everything is fine. Also, I believe it was Brenda Dawes responded by saying everything is fine. So while there was some level of rumble, it was responded to with an indication that, again, this is not something that's ongoing. It's in the past. Everything is fine. Once they got the new allegation, Racine County is very conservative about these things. They don't want to have sexual harassment allegations leveled against them, and they don't want to have a workplace that is unfavorable for anyone. Their ordinance goes well beyond Title VII in terms of what it prohibits in terms of conduct. It says simple joking, even a joke, is inappropriate under the ordinance. Racine County took things seriously, did what an employer should do, and had everyone come in that they could identify as being in the office, investigated. They did so promptly. Their response to it was ultimately the demotion of Mr. Larson, certainly a significant impact, and more importantly, one that worked. There was never any allegation by anyone after the time of his demotion that Mr. Larson was sexually harassing anyone or even acting inappropriately in the workplace.
Doesn't he move to a different department at
yes.
that point as well?
Right. He's taken out of the child support department. He's moved somewhere else physically. And he is demoted, and that is something that was effective. And in terms of looking at whether the response does meet the Farragher-Ellerth affirmative defense, that's very significant. The plaintiffs would have liked to seen him fired because that's the remedy that they would like to have, but cases such as Shaw versus AutoZone say it's not their decision as to what's the appropriate remedy. You look at whether it is reasonable. And in this case, certainly it was a significant impact on him, and it was reasonable. It did send a message to him and everyone else that behavior that violates the ordinance will not be tolerated, and it worked to stop his behavior.
Do you have that offense with respect to Ms. Lasecki? There was there is at least arguably, it seems, there a concrete deprivation.
Well, in Ms. Lasecki's case, she alleges that Mr. Larson had indicated to her at one point that there may be some promotional opportunities. The record does demonstrate that with respect to that conversation, there was not, in fact, any promotional opportunity. Racine County has a procedure for creation of jobs that involves the Finance Committee and approval by HR, the hiring decision couldn't be his. Now, with respect to looking at... Does it need to be his in order for it to qualify as an adverse action?
Yes.
I think it does, yes, because he doesn't have the authority to create a position. And there is case law concerning the fact that an unfulfilled threat, for example, is not an adverse action. The offering of a potential promotion that doesn't exist likewise cannot be an adverse action. There is not any actual financial impact or a job that doesn't exist. And from her perspective, certainly she was disappointed, but there's a legitimate non-discriminatory reason that the promotion did not occur. There's not been any offer of pretext concerning that legitimate non-discriminatory reason, and for that reason as well, it is not an adverse action that can demonstrate actual direct discrimination in this case. I did also want to touch on the argument that the conduct was severe and pervasive, because I think that is also one of the focuses. The district court did consider the allegation concerning daily touching made by Brenda Jackson. Certainly there's a basis upon which the court could have completely disregarded that statement as being overly conclusory because it doesn't give an eye towards what it is that she is actually alleging. The court
But, you know, she does testify. I'm not sure I see anything wrong with somebody saying, here's some examples of the kind of touching that I objected to, and now I'm going to tell you what happened to me on a daily basis. That is direct personal. It's not hearsay. It's not, you know, it's her account of what happened to her on this sort of day-to-day-to-day. And this, frankly, some of the things this man did are so obviously inappropriate to do in a workplace, or for that matter, in any kind of social setting where it's unwelcome.
I agree that he's highly inappropriate. On the other hand, when looking at whether the environment is hellish...
That may be too strict a standard. I mean, it's got to be significant, certainly. But you look at Harris, you look at suitors, for that matter, on the other end of the spectrum. You know, it doesn't have to be so awful that it's a constructive discharge. The Supreme Court has drawn a line.
No, it doesn't.
I must say, I don't understand this. Your brief repeatedly refers to hellish.
Right.
And it raised in my mind the image of somebody whose feet were being held over an open fire. And it's hellish can't possibly be the standard.
Well, it is the standard articulated in case law, but I think what it is...
What do you mean it's the standard articulated in case law? What is the decision of this circuit you rely on for the proposition that unless the workplace is as bad as being in hell, you cannot recover?
I believe in the Baskerville case the word hellish is used. However,
it's different to use a word as a colorful illustration and to establish a legal standard. Not every word in a judicial opinion is a legal standard. So my question remains, what case do you rely on for the proposition that only if the workplace is as bad as being in hell can the plaintiff recover?
I think that Baskerville uses the word, and I understand what you're
saying. If Larson were a demon with a pitchfork, I could easily understand how the plaintiff is going to recover, but can't
right. I understand what you're saying, Your Honor, and that's a very legitimate point. I think the standard is one that's intended to say that it has to be something.
It has to be bad.
It has to be bad, and that's the word that they used in that. And frankly, in our brief, what we're trying to say is that it has to be bad in order to be actionable. And in this particular case, what the problem with the frequency argument, for example, is that Ms. Jackson, she testified to one kiss, yes. With respect to the alleged touching, she didn't say that it was anything, she didn't even identify that it was on an arm, a hand, how he touched. There are kinds of touches that can happen daily in a workplace that may or may not be something that is actionable.
I don't think that's a fair reading of her testimony in a summary judgment context. I could certainly see maybe at a trial that kind of point. But it strikes me she's trying to say this man who's making inappropriate comments about people's bodies and he's sticking wet fingers in ears and he's kissing and he's doing all these gross things. And this one of the ways an environment can be bad is this low-level, constant, degrading behavior. And I think that's what the district court may not have been willing to stand back and take a look at the facts in the light most favorable to the party opposing summary judgment.
I think that the district court refused to infer that there was something more than tangential touching without something more specific. And
it doesn't have to be touching. It could be all verbal.
Right. And that's true. And that leads to the slicing and dicing argument, which is also something that I think I need to address. In this case, we're not taking the position that you can't address the allegations made by each of the plaintiffs. It is, however, important to look at the fact that with respect to Schultz, for example, she does not have any evidence of subjective...
Well, she's dead.
Right.
I mean, so it's a little hard.
Exactly. But that is an element of her claim that she's obligated to prove. And I see my red light on, so I guess if
yes,
there are
thank
any...
thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Knight, anything in rebuttal?
May it please the court. I'm Tricia Knight from Knight & Associates, and I represent Patricia Burchell-Seeloff and the estate of Linda R. Schultz. I wanted to go briefly back over the affirmative defense because I think that's an important one, and I think the timeline here is absolutely crucial. Larson's promoted to manager at the beginning of October of 2000. If we take the facts in the most reasonable light for the plaintiffs, Patricia Burchell-Seeloff within 2 weeks began talking to Marta Colchin, who's an HR manager and a member of the Sexual Harassment Committee, and began telling her about things that he was doing. The testimony that she's certain of is that she did mention his walking around going up to women and saying, "Can I give you a kiss?" and giving them a Hershey kiss. The testimony is also clear that she had frequent conversations during the months of October, November, and December with Marta Colchin, and the conversation was about Larson and his conduct. It's undisputed that in February, Marta Colchin and the entire sexual harassment committee was well aware that you had sexual coercion, quid pro quo, propositions of jobs, touching, where there were multiple women that this was happening to. And the women are saying, well, this may have happened to so-and-so. We're not certain. And all of them are afraid.
But why shouldn't we, you know, we have to deal with something concrete. And if in their depositions people aren't willing to say, just come out and say, you know, I told Marta Colchin way back in November that Larson was a problem and he was creating a sexually harassing environment. They didn't say that, at least as your opponent portrays the depositions.
If you look at Marta Colchin's notes regarding the conversations, the one thing that was said by Sherry Lezecki was that she was very concerned that there may be other women out there and they don't know what to do or how to fight him off or how to handle the situation.
That's Marta Colchin's notes in the record say that?
Yes, and it would be... I'm sorry.
That's okay. You don't have to waste your time. We'll find it if it's in there. Because, I mean, with respect to the affirmative defense, it really seems to me once they buckle down and do this, they do a very good job of investigating everybody, taking action, and so on. So it strikes me your argument has to be either with respect to Lezecki that the affirmative defense isn't available because of the tangible employment action feature, or with respect to the others, it was too late, that there was a period of time during which they should have been taking such actions and they didn't.
It was. It was too little and it was too late. And if you look at the investigative report, which was very thorough, you'll see that a large chunk of the conduct that they are able to document, because it's fresher in their mind, actually occurred after February. And the one thing that that I think is really important here is these women kept going back. You've got the old policy says all they have to do is report the conduct that they believe rises to a harassment level. And then it says the committee shall investigate it within 5 days. That wasn't followed here. It said that it shall contact the county executive. That wasn't done in February. They then go to the sexual harassment training and they say, hey, this is what's happening to us. They go up to Alice Oliver. In fact, in Pat Virgil-Seeloff's deposition, she says she raises her hand in the middle of the training and says, what if you report this and the
right.
county doesn't
Thank
do
you,
anything?
Counsel.
Thank you.
The case will be taken under advisement.
Thank you.